Hey, Curiosity Builders, I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. Do you want to know why I haven't adopted customer relationship management software? Today's guest actually knows the answer and has created a product that eliminates the need to be a perfect data input robot. Jeroen Kortout is co-founder and CEO of SalesFlare, an intelligent CRM built for small businesses, agencies, and fast-growing startup companies. In this episode of Getting Work to Work, Jeroen talks about SalesFlare, how the product came to life by understanding the problem customers had with CRMs, and how automation frees salespeople to sell. With over 600 solutions in the CRM market, several companies with massive resources, Jeroen shares a few ways SalesFlare is competing against those corporate giants. We also talk about his entrepreneurial journey, how he thinks about the big questions of life and work, and the power of partnerships. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/453. Jeroen, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It's wonderful to talk with you today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah, so what are you endlessly curious about?
What am I endlessly curious about? That's a good question. I would say the meaning of life, but that's maybe a super big cliche, but that's something I often think about. I'm very relativistic about it. And I always like to explore it beyond the human aspect, let's say. Mm-hmm. The thing that helped me most last year was reading the latest book of Stephen Hawking, where he explains about why black holes exist and all that.
Wow.
That at that point, that gave me some sense of meaning. It might sound a bit spacey. Like the universe sort of starts existing and energy starts spreading and energy starts like degrading. So it becomes from a higher form of energy, more and more lower form of energy. And then how life forms like us actually help. We are more structured, mm-hmm. but we help things to become more unstructured faster. So to help energy degrade faster. And then that's a really weird sort of idea that actually all this beautiful life exists because then things can come more chaotic faster. Does that make sense?
Yeah, wow.
That's really weird thought. But then I often then lose like the human level, like why do we exist and how can we then keep all this beautiful life actually alive for longer? Mm-hmm. What should we do as humans here? And I think there's like different levels of like caring for each other. Because we're all sort of beautiful, valuable life forms that have created things within this sort of cold universe. We have created some warmth. But then on the other hand, also, how can we make sure that all this life keeps existing as a whole? Like, how can we make sure that this planet persists? Even though we are progressing in so many ways and growing and humans are sort of taking over the planet, something that was unimaginable like 10 million years ago when we're like an animal at the level of the others, how do we deal with that? And then what is my personal place in all that? That's a question then. Like, wow. And I remember at the moment I read the book, I was thinking like my place in there is to help small companies succeed, because small companies, they can bring a lot of these innovations that are needed to make it as a as humanity as a whole. But I'm basically still exploring whether that's really my place or it isn't. I'm not sure. It's a never-ending sort of search. Yeah, I don't know.
That sounds like you know a lot. I mean, wow. I mean, what a big question to really be exploring. And at the same time,
sorry.
It's great. And it's so timely to where we're at in today's world where, you know, having our pulse on the meaning of life is so important when we're kind of surrounded by the same walls day in and day out.
Definitely. And that's actually an issue I had even in the last few days. Mm-hmm. Like this weekend, I was looking like, how can I make life better? And then on Monday, my motivation levels were actually a bit lower until I started understanding that throughout all this work, I started rushing through things and things like started looking the same. And I was sort of approaching it also in a way that everything was at the same level and it was all routine and I had done it before and whatever. But then I figured, what if I just stand still a little bit more? And then now I'm going to use a very cliche word, be more mindful. Be more present in conversations. Mm-hmm. Really take every conversation differently. Like it's not like the previous one. It's a different conversation with a different person or a person that I already spoke to before. But you mean like try to enjoy these things. Try to make more space for connecting with people more deeply, really understanding things, really being there. And just that little mind shift brings already much more meaning to things and much more value, and makes that the days don't become that dull when you're always in between the same walls and, you know, the same place. And I don't know how you deal with it, but it's not always super easy. I'm based in Belgium, Antwerp, Belgium, and just before this chat, I saw a news message coming in. Actually, 10 minutes ago when we started chatting, that we're going into a higher level of sort of urgency again, locking down a bit more again. So it's not over yet, and it's a matter of dealing with it in the right way and actually turning this negative like more and more into a positive.
So I'm curious if you could tell me a little bit about who you are. I mean, you're obviously at a core level, someone who cares about really deep things, but what do you do day in and day out?
A lot of calls, emails, chatting, and yeah, that's mainly what I do, I think. Sometimes writing stuff, and I really enjoy that as well. Mm-hmm. I'm leading a software company. So that basically means that we build a product and we sell that product to people, so, and we make sure that the product is what people need. And next to that, actually, we also create content. It's a stupid word, but it means that we write stuff mostly or record stuff or that helps people beyond our software, because that's actually a good way of... Yeah, first of all, helping people beyond the software. Second, get more attention beyond the software, and then say, oh, and you know, we also have software.
Yeah.
So these are the things I mostly work on. And then a lot of that is on a slightly higher level, in the sense that I don't do everything operationally myself. But then it does include a lot of talking and thinking and discussing. And then... I also take care of a lot of the relationships. So whether that is with investors or with customers or with partners. I mean, for instance, for partners, we have someone taking care of partners. For customers, we have someone taking care of customers and all that. But I also often am in these conversations. And also with people like the accountant, for instance, or whatever, all that. And getting on podcasts, I do that quite often lately as well. So,
yeah. Did you always want to be running your own business, leading teams, and doing things beyond just the corporate grind?
Yes. From before I entered the corporate world, actually, I think my dream there started around when I was 15, 16. Wow. I was like summer vacation, and I discovered the joy of building websites. And I started doing that for people, and I really enjoyed it, like creating stuff, seeing that people were happy with the things I made, maybe adapting it to what they wanted, you know, that whole process. I really enjoyed it. And it must have been around that moment. At that moment, I decided I want to start a web agency. You know, that was a dream back then. Mm-hmm. I started selling second-hand cell phones for a while during my studies. And then I actually studied engineering because that sort of came in my education. And I also felt that it was the best way to get into building things. But I did that with a minor in business management. And after that, I didn't really want to go into any engineering job. I wanted to work with people and build stuff for them and not like have someone else connect with people. No, I wanted to do that myself. Mm. So I went to business school and then actually ended up in a marketing job from there. First to get experience because I felt like I didn't really have experience yet to start my own company. I did go into corporate grind, and that was a huge mistake. It's not like I learned a lot there. I did learn some stuff, and I'm certainly grateful for that. If I would do it all over again, I probably would not. I would skip that step, I would say.
So true. I think I'd skip many steps that I went through to get to where I'm at today. Oh, if we could only turn back time.
Yeah, I went into a so imagine I did biomedical engineering and then business school, and then I figured, okay, so I'm into medical stuff, mm-hmm. and I want to start my own company. What better way is there than to be a product manager in a healthcare company? Because then I sort of have my own products and I put them in the market. So I went looking for that sort of position, and I found that the company was called Baxter. It's actually an American company. And I joined the Belgian office there, taking care of a few products. Mm-hmm. And my dream was sort of immediately shattered because I wasn't really responsible for putting a product in the market. Most of the work was already done. I just basically, to make it concrete, I would take the brochure that they made on the European level. I would hash it up, mm-hmm. translate it in two languages. Because in Belgium, we speak both Dutch and French as official languages, and then German as well, but that's less important. Mm-hmm. And then train the salespeople on how to use it. So that was not at all what I expected it would be. And in the first few months already, I was like, okay, I'm not going to do this for long. I think after 4 or 5 months, I had all kinds of ideas to start a business. Mm-hmm. At around 7 months, my idea was I'm going to start a web agency for pharma companies, you know, my web agency dream coming back. But then I was in a pharma company, so I kind of felt, okay, I know how this works. Mm-hmm. I know how web works. I was building some websites also at Baxter. So, and then I actually met someone who sort of had a company that did that, and I joined them. That was really great. Becoming part of a consultancy slash marketing agency where I could sell and lead projects myself. That was a huge jump from being a product manager in a pharma company. Mm. And much closer to leading my own company.
So was it in that moment where you start learning how to go from just, you know, creating content, creating web pages, to learning how to look at an industry, see what's missing, and create things to fit in that gap?
Yeah, that definitely helped. Like in that job, I had the experience, the possibility to like look at the problems that marketing managers had when they were putting products in the market. And then try to find solutions for that, mostly based on digital marketing. That was really nice. And it was during that time that I started exploring all kinds of startup ideas. I start working part time in that marketing consultancy, and I tried some stuff. I went into the Founder Institute. It's like a global accelerator, and graduated with a company. I found out pretty quickly that the company didn't really have a business model, but at least I had gone through all the steps necessary to sort of create a company, all the different aspects. So I'd done it once, and that helped a lot then to do subsequent ones. Yeah, and Salesflare is now the first one is actually an actual company that is with a team that is actually successful and all that. It's the first one that is doing really well, and probably not the last one that I'll work on.
That's awesome. So did you start the business before you had the product, or did you have the product and start the business? Yeah, like what came first, the chicken or the egg?
First, the business. So, I mean, I would never, I would not recommend to anyone to build a product and then see whether you can sell it. Go from, well, unless the product is like a day to build or so, or a week, then sure. But we started off with, I made a presentation basically outlining our vision, what we're going to build for whom, how we're going to set it in the market and all that. My co-founder made a prototype of what we had in mind so we could show something to people. It did absolutely nothing, but at least we could show, and then they would say, like, oh, that sounds cool, or looks cool. And then we started talking to a lot of people first in a sort of sales way, and at some point we took a few steps back and we started doing customer interviews where we would really explore the issue around the problem we're trying to solve. With people in different positions in different industries to understand the background and know much better against what background we had to build our solution and what the most important things were for us to build and how it should sort of work.
That's awesome. I love the customer interview, how you went from perhaps assumptions to really concrete data from the customers. Like, yeah. Was that just a huge mind shift as well?
It definitely taught us a lot. It's a good step from like having your idea yourself sort of in your head to being able to check that with people, see does it fit in, is it really an issue, all these kind of things. So it's sort of a step number two, you could say. But then it doesn't... You still need to validate whether people want to pay for it. So after that, you try to sell something for a price. You try to get people to use it, and from there, it's a long evolution in always getting customer feedback and adapting what it is that you're building or offering, so that it becomes better and better and better at solving the problem that people have.
So what problem were you trying to solve when you co-founded Salesflare?
It's the problem of salespeople not using CRM systems, and the sort of the problem, while it has lots of different aspects, but when I did customer interviews, people would often respond like, yeah, I mean, salespeople and CRM systems... First of all, they said salespeople are lazy. So it's sort of normal that they don't fill it out. So what you actually have to do, they said, is first you train them well on the CRM systems, because if they don't get it, then of course they won't use it. Second, you make their commission dependent on it. So if they don't fill it out, they get less commission, or they get no commission, or you fire them. You know, it could be that harsh. And another thing you can do is have these weekly or biweekly sales meetings and take them by the hand, go through the CRM system, see where every deal is, and then get a status update on it. And just make sure in that way, in a very forced way, that the system is up to date. when I joined that marketing consultancy that I was talking about, I started with the idea, and that's at least everybody said, like, a CRM is used for you to manage your customer relationships and to be better at sales, right? It's going to help you manage your sales. And we were using Salesforce.com, and it was really my very first CRM. I took it very seriously in that respect, and I really tried to organize myself in it. So I would add tasks and log things and all that. But I very quickly gave up. It was very cumbersome. It was sometimes a bit slow. It didn't really seem like it was made for the century that we were in. And it just didn't really feel like it was built for that purpose. And I felt this issue, and I looked around, and my colleagues actually also weren't really using it. Our CEO really loved it, and he still does, I'm sure, especially for doing reporting. But it just, for us salespeople, we didn't get much further than entering our sales opportunities in there, so he could do the reporting. Or sometimes a contact and put them on the newsletter so we could send out a newsletter. But it didn't really help us sell, you know? So it didn't make sense for us to use it for more than sort of that management reporting. And then I didn't do anything with that insight for a few years, until like one of these projects I was working on during the time that I was part-time at the marketing consultancy, I was working with my co-founder on another software company. And we had gone to a big conference, and we had a lot of leads from that conference, and we wanted to follow them up and sort of build the systems so that we would do that properly. And I knew Salesforce wasn't going to help with that. So we had a good look around. We tested some different CRMs. But what we noticed was that all of these systems failed for us, and it was actually not the systems that failed. It was us who failed. Because we just didn't manage to fill the systems out like we were expected to do it. We didn't really have the necessary discipline to be these perfect data input robots that we sort of felt like we were expected to be. And we thought, like, oh, that's weird. Like, we don't know a lot of perfect data input robots, and especially not salespeople. And then these two things came together, like, okay, so there's these CRM systems that require a lot of data input. They don't really help us sell. So we can see why they become these management reporting systems. But then we also thought about, like, all this data input that we were doing, it was actually data that was sort of, we were duplicating data, let's say. So we were emailing in one system. And then we would go into CRM and say, I emailed, or we were having a meeting, putting that in our calendar, and said, I put a meeting in the calendar, or call someone and on the phone, and then go into the CRM. It's like, I called someone. And in this day and age, all these things are digital. So we figured, like, okay, we just plug into all the other systems and build a CRM that sources all the information that is needed from these different systems, and makes it super easy for people to sort of curate that information, so they don't need to do that manual data input anymore. And then we build a system on top of that really helps people sell. So in practice, like, Salesforce sits on top of your mailbox, and it of course can list emails in timelines when you're looking at companies. It will also automatically create contacts for you and then tell you, like, hey, this seems that you know this person at that company. Do you want to add them to the company or not? Oh, wow. It will pull email signatures from emails and just store that on the contact, so you don't need to, like, look for the last email where they shared an email signature to know where to call them.
Oh, cool.
It will also get some publicly available information from social media, so you don't need to search for that. Same on companies. It will also get some information there. It will map relationships that you have with customers. So you could, for instance, see if you look at a certain company that a certain colleague knows a certain person at the company, and you, even if different like people, like colleagues of yours know that person, you can see who knows that person the best. And that's based on their like the mailbox and the calendar.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So we started building this system that starts mapping all that available information in an automated way, so that salespeople don't really need to put in a lot of effort in trying to do that themselves, because we figured that computers can do that in a way better way than salespeople. And that way, salespeople can actually focus more on their customers, which they are much better at. Like salespeople are good at talking to customers, understanding what their issue is, applying some empathy, trying to come up with the right solution. That's something that computers at this point at least are not so good at yet, but the whole data management thing, that you can leave to the robots, let's say. So the salespeople don't have to be robots anymore, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And we offer that in a system that is that's something that grew over time, but that is very easy to use. And that also actively helps you with following up leads by, for instance, saying like, hey, it's been a while that you contacted this company. Don't drop this. Or, hey, this email here needs responding. Or don't forget to add a meeting note to that, because we see you didn't add it yet. And if you don't add it, then you might forget. And the data will be lost there, because that's a thing that Salesforce doesn't do yet. It doesn't take your meeting notes yet. Obviously, something we want to solve in the future. Mm-hmm. But there's a very, let's say, long roadmap in which we can automate more and more parts of the sales process, so that humans can apply their special human capabilities only in the places where it really makes sense, like where there's really an added value. Short summary.
What I appreciate about, though, I mean, you answer so many questions that I have about CRM software, and you identified many of the reasons why I haven't used it in the past as well, because it's like, I'm not a data robot. I just want to, you know, talk with my customers. But I love that you've solved the problem, not just for sales teams, but for individuals who are responsible for everything, like myself. I'm just me, uh-huh. You know, and so with automation, you know, you remove a lot of the busy work that I don't have really time for and why I haven't adopted anything. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, we indeed have solopreneurs on the software. It goes from one user on the software in a team to about 30 right now. So it's all small and medium-sized businesses.
Yeah, that's cool. So there are over 600 CRMs out there, some of which have massive resources,
yeah.
Like the product you mentioned earlier. Like that is a giant, giant company. So, you know, how do you compete with giants like that as a small business?
It's not easy. So we cannot take the usual sort of roads there. We cannot just throw up a bunch of ads on Google AdWords, for instance, or try to get listed in places in return for a cost per click or per lead, or that's all extremely expensive, because there's one, so many companies out there, and two, some of those are so big and have so many resources, and they have to keep growing. Like either they took a lot of money from venture capitalists, or they are a public company that has a responsibility to grow every quarter by a certain amount. So we sort of need to focus on the channels that are more difficult, that are partly organic, where we can add value in a different way, and also focus much more on the personal relationships with our customers, because that's a place where for bigger companies, it's very hard to compete. For our bigger competitors, like every customer is sort of a number. And for us, we're still such a small team compared to them, where we're all very close to each other, that we can make things function in a different way, and we can really treat them much more as friends and build personal relationships and all those kind of things, which is a thing that they can do. So we need to focus on the things that they cannot do and sort of excel there, because fighting them on the fronts where it's purely a resources game is just, we don't even have to try.
Are there any stories or people that who inspire you to really go up against the giants? Anything that brings you just that energy to day in and day out go for it?
Oh, there's so many, like in the space that we're in, like SaaS companies, software as a service. There's a lot of very cool bootstrapped companies that with not too much resources, not too many resources, really make a difference and build something out there. It's looking at these other companies that are following a similar path that really try to change something for their customers and take it up in maybe a slightly atypical way with maybe some less focus on hitting the results of next quarter and all that, but more on treating customers the right way. And those are the real things that inspire us to take that path as well.
As you're building SalesFlare, what role has partnership and collaboration played in building the company and product?
A big one, actually. We now have one person that is doing that all the time, like 100% of the time. And actually, part of my time also goes into it. So yes, it's important, and it's partnership on many levels. Let's say we partner up with other software companies where we build out integrations, refer people to each other. We could do some content together. We could do a webinar together. I mean, we can help people together, and especially if we share an audience, that's very interesting. We partner up with conferences and podcasts, the sort of partnering up as well, because we're sort of giving each other visibility. We're partnering up with like resellers. So there's many agencies and sales consultancies and that get in touch with CRM that can recommend our software. There's ways that we can help them as well and add value to their lives beyond just sharing a part of the revenue, of course. Mm-hmm. Currently, we're even in talks with some platform/marketplace to be on that. Like partnerships is a big thing for us. Again, also because this is something that we can actually build without having these massive resources.
Yeah. Well, and when you're describing the different partnerships and collaborations that you have and are doing and are going to do, I can't help but think about how important that is, even for, you know, people who are doing graphic design or video production or, mm-hmm. you know, podcast production, media production, any form of creative business. I mean, any business can really do that to a big extent, especially now where a lot of us are spending so much time online in Zoom meetings and you know, podcast recordings. Yeah. Partnership is essential.
Yeah, yeah. And the only danger is there that we sort of touched that earlier, but that you, like what I feel often, for instance, when discussing with other software companies, their partnerships are very, very common, but lots of companies have so many partnerships that it sort of starts becoming like partnerships become a number, if you know what I mean, instead of a, like we said before, like that's these big giants consider their customers like numbers. It sort of starts becoming the same thing there. And that's really a pity, because then you cannot really build these sort of deep, valuable partnerships. Mm-hmm. But part of that is also a matter of not treating this as too much as routine and trying to understand every time we go into a partnership very well what it is that the other party is expecting from it, what you can do for them, what they can do for you, where the win-win is, and then taking some extra time and really building a relationship there beyond the let's say the quote unquote transaction that is the partnership.
So what does the future hold for SalesFlare? What does the future hold for you?
What does the future hold for SalesFlare? So like I said before, the problem of CRM data input, there's still a whole lot of work on that. We can still expand on that in many ways. But beyond that, automating the robotic parts of sales, like the parts on which salespeople are sort of spending their day doing stuff that they aren't really built to do, there's so much to be done there. So it's sort of like an endless roadmap we have there. And for me, there's work there on many levels, like on the product level, on the team level, and on the developing these partnerships and relationships with customers as well. Currently, I can't really tell what I would do beyond SalesFlare. Sometimes I think about it, but I really don't know. So that's a hard one to answer.
Yeah. Well, just to bring an even harder question towards you, how do you bring your curiosity for the meaning of life into SalesFlare, into the work you do?
Yeah, I try to connect these things. So what I was saying before, like helping these small companies strive because they can help change the world for the better and make sure that life persists as we know it, maybe in a different form, but that it persists and persists for the better. SalesFlare has a small role in that by helping companies take care of their customers better, small companies, and in that way, sort of be more successful together with their customers. Because if you don't take care of customer relationships in a proper way, in an organized way, then many of these relationships don't become as deep and as valuable. And that's where a CRM system that actually helps you with these things can really make a difference. It's in making sure that we all work together in a better way at scale.
What a fantastic picture. I love it. Last question for you, Jeroen. What book, podcast, or resource is blowing your mind right now?
The last thing that I encountered that sort of blew my mind was a podcast episode, Invest Like the Best by Patrick O'Shaughnessy. I hope I say it in the right way. There's an episode. It's with Sheer Marotra. It's all very hard to write and pronounce and all that. The episode is called The Art and Science of the Bundle. So it's an episode about bundling, and it explores how bundling actually delivers value. And Sheer, like, tackles four myths that exist when people think about bundling things. I'll dig into the third myth, that bundles always sort of feel like a ripoff to consumers because you buy a bunch of things for a certain price, but you cannot really choose what's in the bundle. So I always like buy things in there that you don't really want. That's the myth. But what is actually the truth is that actually many of these things in there, they can be in there and still it is not a ripoff because you sort of get them for free on top of the things you're already getting. So the way to make that most clear to people is to also show an a la carte price for each of the products that is in the bundle. And then people can quickly start realizing that actually they're getting a whole lot of value for their price. And another myth is, for instance, that you need to, like, for instance, when you think about Spotify, the products in the bundle, which is their songs and artists, they should get the part of the revenue based on usage. But actually, what defines the value of a product in the bundle is not its usage, but its contribution marginally to the churn. So if a certain product would be removed from the bundle, how many people would stop using the bundle? It's like a few simple things, but when you start seeing the myth and understanding the way it actually works, it's really interesting, and it's applicable to so many things and how you can bundle value, especially in the, for instance, the software as a service that we're in. We bundle features in a product, obviously. But there's also opportunities in bundling products together and increasing value that way.
Well, Jeroen, thank you so much for taking time out of your evening to being on Getting Work to Work. It's been a pleasure to hear your stories, learn more about you and the work you're doing. And thank you for helping create software that removes the tasks that don't make us data robots.
You're welcome. I was glad to be here. It was fun.
If there's one takeaway I'm thinking about from this episode, is the importance of truly understanding the customer's problem. Spend some time talking with them, do customer interviews, and truly listen. I know for myself, it can be challenging at times, especially when you can clearly see from your own perspective what's going on. But the more you truly understand, it does lead to better solutions. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.